Davison kept busy getting some of the best loggers and junior officers firmly with him. When he had enough of them, he could really trust a squad of 10 lifted a few items from old Moo's locked-up room in the rec house full of war toys and then went off one Sunday into the woods to play. Davison had located the Creechy town some weeks ago and had saved up the treat for his men. He could have done it single-handed, but it was better this way. You got the sense of comradeship, of a real bond among men. They just walked into the place in broad open daylight and coated all the creatures caught above ground with fire jelly and burned them, then poured kerosene over the warren roofs and roasted the rest. Those that tried to get out got jellied. That was the artistic part, waiting at the rat holes for the little rats to come out, letting them think they'd made it, and then just frying them from the feet up so they made torches. That green fur sizzled like crazy. It actually wasn't much more exciting than hunting real rats, which were about the only wild animals left on Mother Earth. But there was more thrill to it. The creatures were a lot bigger than rats, and you knew they could fight back, though this time they didn't. In fact, some of them even lay down instead of running away, just lay there on their backs with their eyes shut. It was sickening. Every one of them kept his trap shut back at camp, no boasting even to their buddies. So far as old Moo knew, all his men were good little boys just sawing up logs and keeping away from creatures, yes, sir, and he could go on believing that until D-Day came. For the creatures would attack somewhere, here, or one of the camps on King Island, or Central. Davison knew that. He was the only officer in the entire colony that did know it. Nobody else had believed him, except these men here, whom he'd had time to convince. But the others would all see, sooner or later, that he was right. And he was right. It had been a shock meeting Selver face to face. As he flew back to Central from the foothill village, Lyubov tried to decide why it had been a shock. For after all, one isn't usually terrified by a chance meeting with a good friend. It hadn't been easy to get the head woman to invite him. Tuntar had been his main locus of study all summer. He had several excellent informants there and was on good terms with the lodge and with the headwoman, who had let him observe and participate in the community freely. Wangling an actual invitation out of her had taken a long time, but at last she had complied, giving him, according to the new directives, a genuine occasion arranged by the Athshians. His own conscience, rather than the colonel, had insisted on this. Dong wanted him to go. He was worried about the Creechy threat. He told Lyubov to size them up, to see how they're reacting now that we're leaving them strictly alone. He hoped for reassurance. Lyubov couldn't decide whether the report he'd be turning in would reassure the colonel or not. For 10 miles out of Central, the plain had been logged and the stumps had all rotted away. It was now a great, dull flat of fiberweed, hairy gray in the rain. Under those hirsute leaves, the seedling shrubs got their first growth. The sumacs, dwarf aspens, and salviforms, which, grown, would in turn protect the seedling trees. Left alone in this even, rainy climate, this area might reforest itself within 30 years and reattain the full climax forest within 100, left alone. Suddenly the forest began again. Under the helicopter, the infinitely various green of leaves covered the slow swells and folding of the hills of North Sornal. Like most Terrans on Terra, Lyubov had never walked among wild trees at all, never seen a wood larger than a city block. At first, on Athsha, he had felt oppressed and uneasy in the forest, stifled by its endless crowd and incoherence of trunks, branches, leaves, and the perpetual greenish or brownish twilight. The silence made up of many little meaningless noises, the total vegetable indifference to the presence of mind, all this had troubled him. And like the others, he had kept to clearings and to the beach. But little by little, he had begun to like it. And now, after 4 years of it, he was completely at home under the trees, more so, perhaps, than anywhere else. He had also come to like the Athshians' names for their own lands and places, sonorous two-syllabled words, Sornal, Tuntar, Eshref, Eshsen, that was now Centralville, Entor, Abton, and above all, Athsha, which meant the forest and the world. So Earth, Terra, meant both the soil and the planet, two meanings in one. But to the Athshian, soil, ground, earth, was not that to which the dead return and by which the living live. The substance of their world was not earth, but forest. Terran man was clay, red dust. Athshean man was branch and root. He brought the hopper down in a small glade north of the town and walked in past the women's lodge. The smell of an Athshean settlement hung pungent in the air. Wood smoke, dead fish, aromatic herbs, alien sweat. Lyubov had spent many intellectually stimulating hours doubled up and suffocating in the reeking gloom of the men's lodge in Tuntar, but it didn't look as if he would be invited in this time. Of course, the townsfolk knew of the Smith Camp massacre now 6 weeks ago. They would have known of it soon, for word got around fast among the islands. The townsfolk also knew that the 1,200 slaves at Centralville had been freed soon after the Smith Camp massacre, and Lyubov agreed with the colonel that the natives might take the second event to be a result of the first. What was important was that the slaves had been freed. Wrongs done could not be righted, but at least they were not still being done. They could start over. The natives, without that painful, unanswerable wonder as to why the humans treated men like animals, and he without the burden of explanation and the gnawing of irremediable guilt. Knowing how they valued candor and direct speech concerning frightening matters, he expected that people in Tuntar would talk about these things with him in triumph or apology or puzzlement. No one did. No one said much of anything to him. He had come in late afternoon, which was like arriving in a Terran city just after dawn. Athshians did sleep, but their physiological lull was between noon and 4 p.m., whereas with Terrans, it is usually between 2 and 5 a.m., and they had a double peak cycle of high temperature and high activity coming in the two twilights, dawn and evening. Most adults slept 5 or 6 hours in 24, in several catnaps, and adept men slept as little as 2 hours in 24. So if one discounted both their naps and their dreaming states as laziness, one might say they never slept. At this point in Tuntar, things were just beginning to stir again after the late day slump. Lyubov noticed a good many strangers. They looked at him, but none approached. They were mere presences passing on other paths in the dusk of the great oaks. At last, someone he knew came along his path, the headwoman's cousin, Sherar, an old woman of small importance and small understanding. She greeted him civilly, but did not or would not respond to his inquiries about the headwoman and his two best informants, Egath, the orchard keeper, and Tubab, the dreamer. She stuck to Lyubov, and nobody else spoke to him. He worked his way, accompanied by the hobbling, complaining, tiny green crone, across the groves and glades of Tuntar to the men's lodge.
"They're busy in there dreaming. Come along now, Lyubov. Come see the fishing nets."
A girl passed by, one of the young hunters, looked up at him, a stare of animosity such as he had never received from any Athshean, unless perhaps from a little girl, frightened into scowling by his height and his hairless face. But this child was not frightened. If the Athshians had indeed developed, at last and abruptly, the sense of group enmity, then he must accept this and simply try to show them that he remained a reliable friend. But how could their way of feeling and thinking have changed so fast after so long, and why? At Smith Camp, provocation had been immediate and intolerable. Davison's cruelty would drive even Athshians to violence. But this town, Tuntar, had never been attacked by the Terrans, had suffered no slave raids, had not seen the local forest logged or burned. They had got the news from Smith, and there were among them now refugees, ex-slaves, who had suffered at the Terrans' hands and would talk about it. But would news and hearsay change the hearers, change them radically? When their unaggressiveness ran so deep in them, right through their culture and society and on down into their subconscious, their dream time, and perhaps into their very physiology? That an Athshean could be provoked by atrocious cruelty to attempt murder, he knew. He had seen it happen once. That a disrupted community might be similarly provoked by similarly intolerable injuries, he had to believe. It had happened at Smith Camp. But that talk and hearsay, no matter how frightening and outrageous, could enrage a settled community of these people to the point where they acted against their customs and reason, broke entirely out of their whole style of living, this he couldn't believe. Some element was missing. Old Tubab came out of the lodge just as Lyubov passed in front of it. Behind the old man came Selver. Selver crawled out of the tunnel door, stood upright, blinked at the rain-grayed, foliage-dimmed brightness of daylight. His dark eyes met Lyubov's, looking up. Neither spoke. Lyubov was badly frightened. Flying home in the hopper, analyzing the shock, he thought, why fear? Why was I afraid of Selver? Unprovable intuition? Nothing between Selver and Lyubov had changed. What Selver had done at Smith Camp could be justified. Even if it couldn't be justified, it made no difference. The friendship between them was too deep to be touched by moral doubt. They had worked very hard together. They had taught each other, in rather more than the literal sense, their languages. They had spoken without reserve. And Lyubov's love for his friend was deepened by that gratitude the savior feels toward the one whose life he has been privileged to save. Indeed, he had scarcely realized until that moment how deep his liking and loyalty to Selver were. Had his fear, in fact, been the personal fear that Selver might, having learned racial hatred, reject him and treat him not as you, but as one of them? After that long first gaze, Selver came forward slowly and greeted Lyubov, holding out his hands. Touch was a main channel of communication among the forest people. Caress as signal and reassurance was as essential to them as it is to mother and child or to lover and lover, but its significance was social, not only maternal and sexual. It was part of their language. It was therefore patterned, codified, yet infinitely modifiable. So Selver came forward with his hands held out, shook Lyubov's hand, Terran fashion, and then took both his arms in a stroking motion just above the elbow. He was not much more than half Lyubov's height, which made all the gestures difficult and ungainly for both of them, but there was nothing uncertain or childlike in the touch of his small, thin, green-furred hand on Lyubov's arms. It was reassurance. Lyubov was very glad to get it.
Selver, what luck to meet you here. I want very much to talk with you.
I can't now, Lyubov. Lyubov's hope of an unaltered friendship vanished. Selver had changed. He was changed radically from the root.
Can I come back another day and talk with you, Selver? It is important to me.
I leave here today. Selver let go Lyubov's arms and looked away. He thus put himself literally out of touch. Civility required that Lyubov do the same and let the conversation end. But then there would be no one to talk to. Old Tubab had not even looked at him. The town had turned its back on him. And this was Selver, who had been his friend.
Selver, this killing at Kelmedeva, maybe you think that lies between us, but it does not. Maybe it brings us closer together. And your people in the slave pens, they've all been set free, so that wrong no longer lies between us. And even if it does, it always did. All the same, I am the same man I was, Selver.
At first, the Athshian made no response. His strange face turned from Lyubov. Then suddenly he looked round as if against his own intent.
Lyubov, you shouldn't have come here. You should leave Central 2 nights from now. I don't know what you are. It would be better if I had never known you.
And with that, he was off. A light walk like a long-legged cat. A green flicker among the dark oaks of Tuntar. Gone. Tubab followed slowly after him, still without a glance at Lyubov. A fine rain fell without sound on the oak leaves and on the narrow pathways to the lodge and the river. He tried to tell himself that Selber had not been rejecting him as Lyubov, but him as a Terran. It made no difference. It never does. For 2 years, Lyubov had been traveling, studying, interviewing, observing, and had failed to get at the key that would let him into the Athshian mind. He had studied the Athshian's sleeping habits and found that they apparently had no sleeping habits. He had wired countless electrodes onto countless furry green skulls and failed to make any sense at all out of the familiar patterns, the spindles and jags, the alphas and deltas and thetas that appeared on the graph. It was Selver who had made him understand, at last, the Athshian significance of the word dream, which was also the word for root, and so hand him the key of the kingdom of the forest people. It was with Selver as EEG subject that he had first seen with comprehension the extraordinary impulse patterns of a brain entering a dream state neither sleeping nor awake, a condition which related to Terran dream sleeping as the Parthenon to a mud hut. The same thing, basically, but with the addition of complexity, quality, and control. Selver might have escaped. He stayed, first as a valet, then as scientific aide, still locked up nightly with all the other creatures in the pen.
I'll fly you to Tantar and work with you there, Lyubov had said, about the third time he talked with Selvar. For God's sake, why stay here?
My wife, Thela, is in the pen, Selvar had said.
Lyubov had tried to get her released, but she was in the HQ kitchen, and the sergeants who managed the kitchen gang resented any interference from brass and specials. Lyubov had to be very careful, lest they take out their resentment on the woman. She and Selvar had both seemed willing to wait patiently until both could escape or be freed. Male and female creatures were strictly segregated in the pens, and husband and wife rarely saw each other. Lyubov managed to arrange meetings for them in his hut, which he had to himself at the north end of town. It was when Thela was returning to HQ from one such meeting that Davison had seen her and apparently been struck by her frail, frightened grace. He had had her brought to his quarters that night and had raped her. He had killed her in the act. Perhaps this had happened before, a result of the physical disparity, or else she had stopped living. Like some Terrans, the Athshians had the knack of authentic death wish and could cease to live. In either case, it was Davison who had killed her. Such murders had occurred before. What had not occurred before was what Selvar did the second day after her death. Lyubov got there only at the end. He could recall the sounds, himself running down Main Street in hot sunlight, the dust, the knot of men. The whole thing could have lasted only 5 minutes. When Lyubov got there, Selvar was blinded with blood, a sort of toy for Davison to play with, and yet he had picked himself up and was coming back, not with berserk rage, but with intelligent despair. He kept coming back. It was Davison who was scared into rage at last by that terrible persistence. Knocking Selvar down with a side blow, he had moved forward, lifting his booted foot to stamp on the skull. Even as he moved, Lyubov had broken into the circle. He stopped the fight. And thenceforth, he hated Davison and was hated by him, having come between the killer and his death. For if it's all the rest of us who are killed by suicide, it's himself whom the murderer kills. Only he has to do it over and over. Lyubov had picked up Selvar, a lightweight in his arms. The mutilated face had pressed against his shirt so that the blood soaked through against his own skin. He had taken Selvar to his own bungalow, splinted his broken wrist, done what he could for his face, kept him in his own bed, night after night tried to talk to him, to reach him in the desolation of his grief and shame. It was, of course, against regulations. Nobody mentioned the regulations to him. They did not have to. He knew he was forfeiting most of what favor he had ever had with the officers of the colony. Davison, curiously infuriated by the minor injuries Selvar had done him and by Lyubov's interference, had gone around saying he intended to finish off that rebel creature. He certainly would do so if he got the chance. Lyubov stayed with Selvar night and day for 2 weeks and then flew him out of Central and put him down in a west coast town, Broter, where he had relatives. There was no penalty for aiding slaves to escape, since the Athshians were not slaves at all, except in fact. Lyubov was not even reprimanded. But the regular officers distrusted him totally, instead of partially, from then on. And even his colleagues in the special services, the exobiologists, the ag and forestry coordinators, the ecologist, variously let him know that he had been irrational or stupid.
"Did you think you were going on a picnic?" Gossa had demanded.
"No, I didn't think it would be any bloody picnic.
I can't see why any Hilfer voluntarily ties himself up to an open colony. You know the people you're studying are going to get plowed under and probably wiped out. It's the way things are. It's human nature. You must know you can't change that. Then why come and watch the process? Masochism?
I don't know what human nature is. Maybe leaving descriptions of what we wipe out is part of human nature. Is it much pleasanter for an ecologist, really?
All right, then. Write up your descriptions, but keep out of the carnage. A biologist studying a rat colony doesn't start reaching in and rescuing pet rats of his that get attacked, you know."
At this, Lyubov had blown loose. He had taken too much.
"No, of course not. A rat can be a pet, but not a friend."
That had hurt poor old Gossa, who wanted to be a father figure to Lyubov. And it had done nobody any good. Yet it had been true. "I like Selvar, respect him, saved him, suffered with him, fear him. Selvar is my friend. Selvar is a god. Selvar Sha'ab." What did Sha'ab mean, though? Many words of the women's tongue, the everyday speech of the Athshians, came from the men's tongue that was the same in all communities, and these words often were not only two-syllabled, but two-sided. Sha'ab meant God, or numinous entity, or powerful being. It also meant something quite different, but Lyubov could not remember what. By this stage in his thinking, he was home in his bungalow, and had only to look it up in the dictionary which he and Selver had compiled in 4 months of exhausting but harmonious work. Of course, Sha'ab, translator. It was almost too pat. Were the two meanings connected? Often they were, yet not so often as to constitute a rule. If a god was a translator, what did he translate? Was a Sha'ab one who translated the language of dream and philosophy, the men's tongue, into the everyday speech? But all dreamers could do that. Might he then be one who could translate into waking life the central experience of vision, one serving as a link between the two realities, considered by the Athshians as equal, the dream time and the world time, whose connections, though vital, are obscure? A link. One who could speak aloud the perceptions of the subconscious. To speak that tongue is to act, to do a new thing, to change or to be changed radically from the root. For the root is the dream, and the translator is the god. Selver had brought a new word into the language of his people. He had done a new deed. The word, the deed, murder. Only a god could lead so great a newcomer as death across the bridge between the worlds. But had he learned to kill his fellow men among his own dreams of outrage and bereavement, or from the undreamed of actions of the strangers? Was he speaking his own language, or was he speaking Captain Davison's? That which seemed to rise from the root of his own suffering and express his own changed being might in fact be an infection, a foreign plague, which would not make a new people of his race, but would destroy them. Raj Lyubov's character and training disposed him not to interfere in other men's business. His job was to find out what they did, and his inclination was to let them go on doing it. But even the most unmissionary soul, unless he pretends he has no emotions, is sometimes faced with a choice between commission and omission. What are they doing abruptly becomes, what are we doing? And then, what must I do? That he had reached such a point of choice now, he knew, and yet did not know clearly why, nor what alternatives were offered him. He could do no more to improve the Athshian's chance of survival at the moment. Lepenin, Orr, and the Ansible had done more than he had hoped to see done in his lifetime. The administration on Terra was explicit in every Ansible communication, and Colonel Dong, though under pressure from some of his staff and the logging bosses to ignore the directives, was carrying out orders. Policy was no longer static. A decision by the League of Worlds might now lead overnight to the colonies being limited to one land, or forbidden to cut trees, or encouraged to kill natives. No telling. How the League worked and what sort of policies it was developing could not yet be guessed from the flat directives of the administration. The colonists were letting the Athshians alone, and they were letting the colonists alone. A healthy situation, and one not to be disturbed unnecessarily. The only thing likely to disturb it was fear. At the moment, the Athshians might be expected to be suspicious and still resentful, but not particularly afraid. As for the panic felt in Centralville at the news of the Smith Camp massacre, nothing had happened to revive it. No Athshian anywhere had shown any violent sense, and with the slaves gone, the Creechies all vanished back into their forests, there was no more constant irritation of xenophobia. The colonists were at last beginning to relax. If Lyubov reported that he had seen Selver at Tantar, Dong and the others would be alarmed. They might insist on trying to capture Selver and bring him in for trial. The colonial code forbade prosecution of a member of one planetary society under the laws of another, but the court-martial overrode such distinctions. They could try, convict, and shoot Selver. So he made his choice without even knowing he had made one. He turned in a brief report that next day. It said that Tantar was going about its business as usual, and that he had not been turned away or threatened. It was a soothing report, and the most inaccurate one Lyubov ever wrote. It omitted everything of significance. Otherwise, the report was quite factual, he thought. He had merely omitted subjective impressions, as a scientist should. He had a severe migraine while writing the report, and a worse one after submitting it. He dreamed a lot that night. but could not remember his dreams in the morning. Late in the second night after his visit to Tantar, he woke, and in the hysterical whooping of the alarm siren and the thudding of explosions, he faced, at last, what he had refused. He was the only man in Centralville not taken by surprise. In that moment, he knew what he was. A traitor. And yet, even now, it was not clear in his mind that this was an Athsian raid. It was the terror in the night. His own hut had been ignored, standing in its yard away from other houses. Perhaps the trees around it protected it, he thought as he hurried out. The center of town was all on fire. Even the stone cube of HQ burned from within like a broken kiln. The Ansible was in there, the precious link. There were fires also in the direction of the helicopter port and the field. Where had they got explosives? How had the fires got going all at once? All the buildings along both sides of Main Street, built of wood, were burning. The sound of the burning was terrible. Lyubov ran towards the fires. Water flooded the way. He thought at first it was from a fire hose, then realized the main from the river Menand was flooding uselessly over the ground while the houses burned with that hideous sucking roar. How had they done this? There were guards. There were always guards in jeeps at the field. Shots, volleys, the yatter of a machine gun. All around Lyubov were small running figures, but he ran among them without giving them much thought. He was abreast of the hostel now, and saw a girl standing in the doorway, fire flickering at her back, and a clear escape before her. She did not move. He shouted at her, then ran across the yard to her and wrested her hands free of the door jams, which she clung to in panic, pulling her away by force. She came then, but not quite soon enough. As they crossed the yard, the front of the upper story, blazing from within, fell slowly forward, pushed by the timbers of the collapsing roof. Shingles and beams shot out like shell fragments. A blazing beam end struck Lyubov and knocked him sprawling. He lay face down in the firelit lake of mud. He did not see a little green-furred huntress leap at the girl, drag her down backwards, and cut her throat. He did not see anything. No songs were sung that night. There was only shouting and silence. When the flying ships burned, Selvar exulted, and tears came into his eyes, but no words into his mouth. He turned away in silence, the fire thrower heavy in his arms, to lead his group back into the city. Each group of people from the west and north was led by an ex-slave like himself, one who had served the humans in Central and knew the buildings and ways of the city. Most of the people who came to attack that night had never seen the human city. Many of them had never seen a human. They had come because they followed Selvar, because they were driven by the evil dream and only Selvar could teach them how to master it. There were hundreds and hundreds of them, men and women. They had waited in utter silence in the rainy darkness all around the edges of the city, while the ex-slaves, two or three at a time, did those things which they judged must be done first: break the water pipe, cut the wires that carried light from generator house, break into and rob the arsenal. The first deaths, those of the guards, had been silent, accomplished with hunting weapons, noose, knife, arrow, very quickly, in the dark. The dynamite, stolen earlier in the night from the logging camp 10 miles south, was prepared in the arsenal, the basement of HQ building, while fires were set in other places. And then the alarm went off, and the fires blazed, and both night and silence fled. Most of the thunderclap and treefall crashing of gunfire came from the humans defending themselves, for only ex-slaves had taken weapons from the arsenal and used them. All the rest kept to their own lances, knives, and bows. But it was the dynamite placed and ignited by Reshwan and the others who had worked in the logger's slave pen that made the noise that conquered all other noises and blew out the walls of the HQ building and destroyed the hangars and the ships. There were about 1,700 humans in the city that night, about 500 of them female. All the human females were said to be there now. That was why Selvar and the others had decided to act, though not all the people who wished to come had yet gathered. Between 4,000 and 5,000 men and women had come through the forest to the meeting at Entor, and from there to this place, to this night. The fires burned huge, and the smell of burning and of butchering was foul. Selvar's mouth was dry and his throat sore, and longed for water to drink. He parted his lips and hoarsely sent up the home call that ends the hunt. Those with him took it up more clearly and loudly. Other voices answered it, near and far off in the mist and reek and flame-shot darkness of the night. Instead of leading his group at once from the city, he signaled them to go on and himself went aside, onto the muddy ground between the path and a building which had burned and fallen. He stepped across a dead female human and bent over one that lay pinned under a great charred beam of wood. He could not see the features obliterated by mud and shadow. It was not just, it was not necessary. He need not have looked at that one among so many dead. He need not have known him in the dark. He started to go after his group. Then he turned back, straining, lifted the beam off Lyubov's back, knelt down, slipping one hand under the heavy head so that Lyubov seemed to lie easier, his face clear of the earth, and so knelt there, motionless. He had not slept for 4 days and had not been still to dream for longer than that. He did not know how long. He had acted, spoken, traveled, planned, day and night ever since he left Broter with his followers from Kadest. He had gone from city to city, speaking to the people of the forest, telling them the new thing, waking them from the dream into the world, arranging the thing done this night, talking, always talking and hearing others talk, never in silence and never alone. They had listened, they had heard and had come to follow him, to follow the new path. They had taken up the fire they feared into their own hands, taken up the mastery over the evil dream, and loosed the death they feared upon their enemy. All had been done as he had said it should be done. All had gone as he had said it would go. The lodges and many dwellings of the humans were burnt, their airships burnt or broken, their weapons stolen or destroyed, and their females were dead. The fires were burning out, the night growing very dark, fouled with smoke. Selvar could scarcely see. He looked up to the east, wondering if it were nearing dawn. Kneeling there in the mud among the dead, he thought, "This is the dream now, the evil dream. I thought to drive it, but it drives me." In the dream, Lyubov's lips moved a little against the palm of his own hand. Selvar looked down and saw the dead man's eyes open. The flare of dying fires shone on the surface of them. After a while, he spoke Selvar's name. "Lyubov, why did you stay here? I told you to be out of the city this night." So Selvar spoke in dream, harshly, as if he were angry at Lyubov. "Are you the prisoner?" Lyubov said, faintly and not lifting his head, but in so commonplace a voice that Selvar knew for a moment that this was not the dream time, but the world time, the forest's night. "Or am I?" "Neither, both. How do I know? All the engines and machines are burned. All the women are dead. We let the men run away if they would. I told them not to set fire to your house. The books will be all right. Lyubov, why aren't you like the others?"
"I am like them, a man like them, like you."
"No, you are different.
I am like them, and so are you. Listen, Selvar, don't go on. You must go back to your own, to your roots.
When your people are gone, then the evil dream will stop."
"Now."
Lyubov tried to lift his head, but his back was broken. He looked up at Selvar and opened his mouth to speak. His gaze dropped away and looked into the other time, and his lips remained parted, unspeaking. His breath whistled a little in his throat. They were calling Selvar's name, many voices far away, calling over and over.
"I can't stay with you, Lyubov."
Selvar stood up and tried to run away. But in the dream darkness he could go only very slowly, like one wading through deep water. The ash spirit walked in front of him, taller than Lyubov or any human, tall as a tree, not turning its white mask to him. As Selvar went, he spoke to Lyubov.
"We'll go back. I will go back. Now. We will go back now, I promise you, Lyubov."
But his friend, the gentle one, who had saved his life and betrayed his dream, Lyubov did not reply. He walked somewhere in the night near Selvar, unseen and quiet as death. A group of the people of Tantar came on Selvar wandering in the dark, weeping and speaking, overmastered by dream. They took him with them in their swift return to Entor. In the makeshift lodge there, a tent on the riverbank, he lay helpless and insane for 2 days and nights while the old men tended him. All that time, people kept coming in to Entor and going out again, returning to the place of Eshsen, which had been called Central, burying their dead there and the alien dead. Of theirs, more than 300. Of the others, more than 700. There were about 500 humans locked into the compound, the creature pens, which, standing empty and apart, had not been burnt. As many more had escaped, some of whom had got to the logging camps farther south, which had not been attacked. Those who were still hiding and wandering in the forest or the cut lands were hunted down. Some were killed, for many of the younger hunters and huntresses still heard only Selvar's voice saying, "Kill them." Others had left the night of killing behind them as if it had been a nightmare, the evil dream that must be understood lest it be repeated. And these, faced with a thirsty, exhausted human cowering in a thicket, could not kill him. So maybe he killed them. There were groups of 10 and 20 humans armed with loggers' axes and handguns, though few had ammunition left. These groups were tracked until sufficient numbers were hidden in the forest about them, then overpowered, bound, and led back to Eshsen. They were all captured within 2 or 3 days, for all that part of Sornal was swarming with the people of the forest. There had never in the knowledge of any man been half or a tenth so great a gathering of people in one place. Some still coming in from distant towns and other lands, others already going home again. The captured humans were put in among the others in the compound, though it was overcrowded and the huts were too small for humans. They were watered, fed twice daily, and guarded by a couple of 100 armed hunters at all times. In the afternoon following the night of Eshsen, an airship came rattling out of the east and flew low as if to land, then shot upward like a bird of prey that misses its kill and circled the wrecked landing place, the smoldering city, and the cut lands. Reshwan had seen to it that the radios were destroyed, and perhaps it was the silence of the radios that had brought the airship from Kushil or Raishwell, where there were 3 small towns of humans. The prisoners in the compound rushed out of the barracks and yelled at the machine whenever it came rattling overhead, and once it dropped an object on a small parachute into the compound. At last, it rattled off into the sky. There were 4 such wing ships left on Athsha now, all of the small kind that carried 4 men. They also carried machine guns and flamethrowers, and they weighed much on the minds of Reshwan and the others while Selvar lay lost to them, walking the cryptic ways of the other time. He woke into the world time on the 3rd day, thin, dazed, hungry, silent. After he had bathed in the river and had eaten, he listened to Reshwan and the headwoman of Bara and the others chosen as leaders. They told him how the world had gone while he dreamed. When he had heard them all, he looked about them, and they saw the god in him. In the sickness of disgust and fear that followed the night of Eshsen, some of them had come to doubt. Their dreams were uneasy and full of blood and fire. They were surrounded all day by strangers, people come from all over the forests, hundreds of them, thousands, all gathered here like kites to carrion, none knowing another, and it seemed to them as if the end of things had come and nothing would ever be the same or be right again. But in Selvar's presence they remembered purpose, their distress was quieted, and they waited for him to speak. "The killing is all done. Make sure that everyone knows that. I have to talk with the ones in the compound. Who is leading them in there?"
"Turkey, flap feet, wet eyes."
"Turkey's alive? Good. Help me get up, Greta. I have eels for bones." When he had been afoot for a while, he was stronger, and within the hour he set off for Eshsen, 2 hours' walk from Entor. When they came, Reshwan mounted a ladder set against the compound wall and bawled in a pidgin English taught the slaves,
"Donga come to gate, hurry up quick."
Down in the alleys between the squat cement barracks, some of the humans yelled and threw clods of dirt at him. He ducked and waited. The old colonel did not come out, but Gossa, whom they called Wet Eyes, came limping out of a hut.
"Colonel Dung is ill, he cannot come out."
The gate was open just wide enough and long enough for Gossa to squeeze out. He stood in front of it alone, facing the group by Selvar. He favored one leg, injured, on the night of Eshsen. He was wearing town pajamas, mud-stained and rain-sodden. His graying hair hung in lank festoons around his ears and over his forehead. Twice the height of his captors, he held himself very stiff and stared at them in courageous, angry misery.
"What do you want?"
"We must talk, Mr. Gossa."
I'm Selvar of the Ash Tree of Eshreth. I'm Lyubov's friend.
Yes, I know you. What have you to say?
I have to say that the killing is over. If that be made a promise kept by your people and my people, you may all go free if you will gather in your people from the logging camps in South Sornal, Kushil, and Tishwell, and make them all stay together here. You may live here where the forest is dead, where you grow your seed grasses. There must not be any more cutting of trees.
The camps weren't attacked?
No. There are less than 2,000 of your people left living in the world, I think. Your women are all dead. In the other camps, there are still weapons. You could kill many of us, but we have some of your weapons, and there are more of us than you could kill. I suppose you know that, and that's why you have not tried to have the flying ships bring you fire throwers and kill the guards and escape. It would be no good. There really are so many of us. If you make the promise with us, it will be much the best, and then you can wait without harm until one of your great ships comes, and you can leave the world. That will be in 3 years, I think.
Yes, 3 local years. How do you know that?
Well, slaves have ears, Mr. Gossa.
We had already promised not to hurt any of your people. It's why the workers were sent home. It did no good. You didn't listen.
It was not a promise made to us.
How can we make any sort of agreement or treaty with a people who have no government, no central authority?
I don't know. I'm not sure you know what a promise is. This one was soon broken.
What do you mean? By whom? How?
In Rishwell, New Java, 14 days ago, a town was burned and its people killed by humans of the camp in Rishwell.
It's a lie. We were in radio contact with New Java right along until the massacre. Nobody was killing natives there or anywhere else.
You're speaking the truth you know. I, the truth I know. I accept your ignorance of the killings on Rishwell, but you must accept my telling you that they were done. This remains. The promise must be made to us and with us, and it must be kept. You will wish to talk about these matters with Colonel Dong and the others.
Who are you, Selvar? Was it you that organized the attack? Did you lead them?
Yes, I did.
Then all this blood is on your head. Lyubov's too, you know. He's dead. Your friend Lyubov.
Selvar did not understand the idiom. He had learned murder, but of guilt he knew little beyond the name. As his gaze locked for a moment with Gossa's pale, resentful stare, he felt afraid. A sickness rose up in him, a mortal chill. He tried to put it away from him, shutting his eyes a moment. Lyubov is my friend, and so not dead.
Your children, children, savages, you have no conception of reality. This is no dream, this is real. You killed Lyubov, he's dead. You killed the women, you burned them alive, slaughtered them like animals.
Should we have let them live to breed like insects in the carcass of the world? To overrun us? We killed them to sterilize you. I know what a realist is, Mr. Gossa. Lyubov and I have talked about these words. A realist is a man who knows both the world and his own dreams. You're not sane. There's not one man in 1,000 of you who knows how to dream. Not even Lyubov, and he was the best among you. You sleep, you wake, and forget your dreams. You sleep again, and wake again, and so you spend your whole lives, and you think that that is being, life, reality. You are not children, you are grown men, but insane. And that's why we had to kill you, before you drove us mad. Now go back and talk about reality with the other insane men. Talk long and well. The guards opened the gate, threatening the crowding humans inside with their spears. Gossa re-entered the compound, his big shoulders hunched as if against the rain. Selvar was very tired. He was too weary to eat. He drank a little hot broth and lay down by the men's fire. Entor was no town, but a mere camp by the great river.
a favorite fishing place for all the cities that had once been in the forest round about before the humans came. There were many old men at the fire, some of whom he knew from Brotur and Tuntar and his own destroyed city, Eshreth. Some whom he did not know. He could see in their eyes and gestures and hear in their voices that they were great dreamers, more dreamers than had ever been gathered in one place before, perhaps. Lying stretched out full length, his head raised on his hands, gazing at the fire, he said, "I have called the humans mad. Am I mad myself?"
"You don't know one time from the other, because you did not dream either sleeping or waking for far too long. The price for that takes long to pay. The poisons the humans take do much the same as does the lack of sleep and dream. The humans poison themselves in order to dream. I saw the dreamers look in them after they took the poisons. But they couldn't call the dreams, nor control them, nor weave, nor shape, nor cease to dream. They were driven, overpowered. They did not know what was within them at all. So it is with a man who hasn't dreamed for many days. Though he be the wisest of his lodge, still he'll be mad, now and then, here and there, for a long time after. He'll be driven, enslaved. He will not understand himself. My young god, you need to sing. That would do you good."
"I can't. Sing for me." The man sang. Others joined in, their voices high and reedy, almost tuneless, like the wind blowing in the water reeds of Endor.